Hi, everyone. Welcome back, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Henrik, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. On our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com, you can find all our previous programs and archives, news, videos, resources, links, and much more. We are going to continue our Secret Space Program pre-conference series that we've been doing with the speakers that will be at the conference at the end of June in San Mateo to discuss the breakaway civilization concept. I'll be hosting this event, so I do hope that we can see you there and that you'll check out their website, secretspaceprogram.org. The speakers include Joseph P. Farrell, Catherine Austin Fitz, Carol Rosen, Richard Dolan, John Rappaport, Robert Morningstar, Michael Schratt, and also Mark McCandlish, who we'll be speaking with today. Mark is an internationally recognized artist who has specialized in aviation and conceptual art within the defense and aerospace industries for the better part of the last 30 years. Mark's father was a 25-year veteran of the United States Air Force, and as a consequence, Mark has had a lifelong love for aircraft and aviation history. His first UFO sighting occurred at Westover Air Force Base in Massachusetts. He later discovered that this craft had been hovering above a flight of nuclear-armed Boeing B-52 sitting on the alert ramp of the flight line on base. He observed the craft for about 10 minutes before it accelerated out of sight at an extreme velocity. Mr. McCandlish has spent most of his life trying to discover the science that would make the incredible performance that this craft exhibited possible. Mark will discuss the plausibility how interstellar flight is possible without violating the currently accepted laws of physics. He has had dozens of sightings since his first one in 1966. He feels certain that this carefully protected technology has been co-opted by an as-yet unknown group, and the sequestering of this technology has provided that organization tremendous leverage in world politics, finance, and international conflicts over the past five decades. Welcome, Mark. Thank you very much for coming on with us today. It's great to have you here. I hope you're doing well today.
Thank you. It's indeed, a pleasure to be able to speak with you. I consider it a great privilege to be invited to speak at the Secret Space Program Breakaway Civilizations Conference, and I'm looking forward to that.
Indeed. I feel grateful for being invited as the host as well. It's going to be a very interesting time there, I believe, and we'll talk a little bit more about the conference later, of course. But you have some fascinating material that you've been speaking about, and when it comes to specifically the development of black budget, off-black budget programs intended to develop advanced military aerospace vehicles and everything else. You've spoken with the eyewitnesses, some extraordinary testimony there. And of course, you were one of the voices in the Disclosure Project as well. So before we get into some of that, maybe you can just tell our audience, Mark, a little bit more about your background. You've worked for defense contractors, I believe. You've also been at the McCord Air Force Base in Tacoma, Washington. You've done repairs and various things there. Tell us about your background a bit.
Well, my dad was a 25-year veteran of the U.S. Air Force, and we traveled quite a bit when he was moved from one air base to another. In around 1966, I had taken up an interest in astronomy, and I had one of those Gilbert Science Company 80-power reflector telescopes that I used quite a bit. So I was out under the stars watching the sky quite a bit. At that time, we were settled at a strategic air command base in Massachusetts called Westover Air Force Base. They had nuclear weapons on the base, Boeing B-52 Stratofortress aircraft and so forth. And on one night in February of 66, I was asked to take the family dog out one last time before we retire for the evening, and saw an object hovering in the distance without the usual anti-collision lights that you would expect to see on a normal aircraft. So I ran in the house, grabbed my telescope, and I watched this thing through the telescope for the better part of 10 minutes. And it was pretty obvious that it was not a conventional aircraft. It looked more like a large ball of plasma with color sort of swirling across the surface. Something like the rainbow of colors that you see in a mud puddle when there's a droplet of oil that's sort of spread across to the surface of the water and the bubbles and so forth. You know, the colors were swirling around. And after about 10 minutes, this thing began to move off, and then it zipped away like it had been fired out of a cannon. It was just gone in an instant. And that was when I began to realize that there was something else going on in the sky besides just meteors and stars and airplanes. And it turned out that it wasn't until probably 5 or 6 years ago that I discovered Google Earth. And I decided to go up on Google Earth and take a look at a satellite view of Westover Air Force Base. And I oriented the picture so that I could see where I was standing at the moment that I had my telescope out and where this thing was actually hovering. And it was then that I discovered, in fact, you can see this yourself if you go up on Google Earth, there is a section of the runway where there is a sort of a tributary runway, a little spur that goes off to one side, and it has kind of a herringbone pattern of smaller runways. And this particular area was where they kept the nuclear-armed flight of B-52s that were there in readiness if we ever got into a shooting conflict with Red China or the Soviet Union. And so it turns out that this UFO was hovering directly over a flight of B-52s that were loaded with nuclear weapons. It was pretty interesting. But anyway, after I went through high school and decided I wanted to design cars for General Motors and that sort of thing, I realized the only place that I could get that kind of an education was at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California. But it was a very expensive private institution to attend. And the only way I could really afford that was to go into the Air Force myself and get the GI Bill to help pay for my college education. So I joined the Air Force, and wound up working on F-106 fighter interceptors with the 318th Fighter Interceptor Squadron at McCord Air Force Base in Tacoma in the state of Washington. And went through an electronics school. We had a section of the base where they had nuclear weapons because this particular interceptor was designed with an internal weapons bay to minimize the parasitic drag on the aircraft when it was going out to face off with the Russians when they came up along the coast of the United States back during the Cold War. And it was at about that same time that we had an incident. We had a code name for it. They were called covered wagon exercises. It's basically an instance where an unknown aircraft type is approaching the coast of the United States. It's unidentified and that it's considered to be a threat. So they scramble four of our alert aircraft, which have two radar-guided missiles, two infrared-guided missiles, and one nuclear weapon, just in case it's something big. And it turned out that years later, after the incident, which apparently was classified, this was in June or July of 1974, I believe, it turned out that I met up with the author, William Cooper, who wrote the book Behold a Pale Horse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it turned out that he was on a submarine out of Bremerton, Washington at that same time. And as they were making a transit between Bremerton and Hawaii, they had a close encounter with a large undersea object that came out of the ocean and basically flew off out into space. And so I found that that was an interesting coincidence there. But after I got out of the Air Force and decided to go to college on the GI Bill, I eventually figured out that working for one of the large auto manufacturers was not something that was really going to be possible. They were cutting back on the number of staff because of the oil embargo and the downsizing of vehicles, the competition from Japan coming over to the United States with less expensive vehicles. So it didn't look like there was going to be a job for me there. So I spent a little time working in the movie industry as a special effects matte artist, and then transitioned over to the defense industry working as a conceptual artist and technical publications editor for General Dynamics in Pomona, California. And it was a very exciting time because there were a lot of advanced development weapon systems that were being worked on. And, you know, as a guy who's always turned the wrench on his own vehicles and been very mechanically inclined all my life, you know, it was kind of exciting for me to climb all over these machines, you know, go down to the bowels of a battleship and see how these things were put together. And so it gave me an opportunity to learn about a lot of different kinds of technologies, things that involved infrared and radar systems, microwave weapon systems, high-energy lasers, the railgun project, where they had projectiles that could, actually achieve escape velocity, go right out into space. So it was a very exciting time for me. And after spending a couple of years with General Dynamics, I left the company and began freelancing throughout the defense industry. So I had an opportunity to see a really nice cross-section of all the different kinds of technology that were being used throughout the industry at that time. And this is between 1982 and 1986 or so.
1982, 1986. Okay, that is a while ago, though. How would you describe, with your perspective today, what they did back then, some of the programs they worked on? I guess the success rate. We're all trying to figure out what actually exists in terms of the arsenals, not only weaponry, of course, exotic weaponry, but also primarily aerospace vehicles, and how advanced and how much they actually have gotten out of all the billions that they've poured into these programs, Mark.
Well, it's true that if you take a historical retrospective on the weapons development programs, and you have to understand that a lot of these, the more classified, the more advanced technologies, are highly compartmentalized, which means that unless you're actually involved in the program and contributing to it, if you do not have a need to know, you're not going to really hear about it. And so it's a very rare event when some of these things pop up in a location where an average citizen has a chance to glimpse some of these things. And very often, you find people claiming that they've seen a flying saucer or UFO when it's merely one of our advanced weapon systems that happened to stray outside the boundaries of a test area that's, close to the public. So these kinds of incidents do happen. You do have people that will occasionally describe events where, because of an unusual string of events, they actually encounter or have an opportunity to see these things, and usually they're taken aside very quickly, almost like an arrest type of situation, and they are debriefed about what they've seen, and usually required to sign some kind of a security oath or non-disclosure agreement that in many cases will actually increase the level of security that they are now expected to observe from that point on. But very often, 20, 30 years later, these people are a little bit more relaxed about describing the things that they saw. And so that was the kind of situation in which I found myself, where I would strike up a conversation or establish a friendly relationship with clients, and over time would be able to engage these individuals in conversations where they would talk about things that they had seen personally in hangars in various locations around the country, around the world, depending on where the site for testing was taking place. And so this was how a lot of this kind of information came into my possession. I think probably the strangest introduction to a clear the way that I became aware of this, the fact that there was sort of a much higher level of technology that was sort of operating in the background of every situation, was when I was asked by Lockheed to create an illustration to help them promote a proposed aircraft type that they were interested in developing. And it was described as a second generation of aircraft that was in an existing family of vehicles that had already been developed, had already been in deployment, but that it had greater capability in terms of its speed and altitude. They couldn't tell me what it looked like. They couldn't tell me what it was called, but they asked me to do an illustration of an aircraft that looked really fast. I mean, this was how they wanted. They wanted a flashy piece of artwork to show to a Senate Appropriations Committee so they could get millions of dollars to develop this thing. And, of course, anytime you say it flies higher and faster than the other guy, the people who have the purse strings get very excited. So I, went and had a meeting with this fellow in Calabasas, California, I went home with a lot of excitement about what I was going to be able to do. And so I decided that this was an aircraft that was going to be flying, right out at the very edge of space where there was still some air that could be used for the combustion process of the engines. I had been reading a lot of the trade journals at that time, like Jane's Defense Weekly, Navy Proceedings, Aviation Week, and Space Technology magazines, and subscribed to many of those. And so I was aware of something that was under development called the supersonic combustion ramjet, or scramjet. And the biggest problem that they had back then was the material science that would enable these kinds of technologies to be used, because you're talking about extremely high temperatures, temperatures high enough to melt steel, just from the friction of flying through the air so fast. And so a lot of what had to be developed were types of metallic ceramic composites that would enable the leading edges of many of these appendages, the engine openings, the leading edge of the aircraft, to be able to withstand the kind of heat friction from the air passing over the vehicle so quickly. So I had an awareness of what it would take to create an aircraft like this, what it would have to look like. And they didn't tell me anything about the propulsion system, but I had known from reading the trade journals that a lot of these systems were designed so that they had multiple propulsion systems. That is to say, they had, say, a conventional high-bypass turbojet engine that would allow the vehicle to take off and land, mm-hmm. and they had a series of articulated valves, I guess you might say, or ducts that would open and close so that it would expose the turbine blades for one part of this system so that it could take off and land, and then the air would be sort of redirected into the high bypass or the scramjet part of the engine so that it could operate in a higher altitude, higher velocity regime. So this is what I incorporated into the aircraft. And I looked at the history of aviation, and I saw that the two fastest known aircraft that had ever been built by the United States was the XB-70 Valkyrie, which was created by North American Aircraft back in the early 1960s. And eventually was canceled because the Soviets had developed the MiG-25 Foxbat, which was a high-altitude, high-speed interceptor. So they were looking at other things like stealth. Then I also looked at the SR-71 Blackbird, which was, you know, a Mach 2-plus capable aircraft, which in its initial variant, YF-12A, I believe it was, had an internal weapons bay just like the F-106 that I had worked on in the 1970s, because it reduced all the parasitic drag of having, you know, bombs or weapons slung under the wings. It just kept everything smooth and aerodynamically efficient. So I combined the features of the XB-70 and the SR-71. Now, both aircraft had kind of a large triangular wing towards the tail end of the aircraft. Both vehicles had two vertical stabilizers, or tails, you know, for the layman. And the XB-70 had a pair of smaller wings up towards the front end. It had kind of a fuselage that came up off the triangular wing, sort of like a gooseneck, with the cockpit sort of pointing downward a little bit. And then right behind the cockpit were a pair of smaller wings called canards, which would help with preventing stalls and this kind of thing. So the SR-71 Blackbird also had the triangular wing, also had the two vertical tails. But it also had something called a chine, which was part of its stealthy characteristic. It had a kind of like an edge that ran down the sides of the fuselage, which would help to sort of deflect incoming radar signals and make it a little bit harder to detect by an enemy radar system. And so I incorporated the features of these two aircraft into a single design, which was really kind of a long gooseneck fuselage with canards and a chine. And I also incorporated the canards right into the edge of the chine in such a way that, sort of like the F-111, General Dynamics F-111, that had the variable sweep wings, I set this up so that the canards could actually be retracted into the chine and extended outward. And then I put a couple of scramjet engines, which are kind of like a box, really a long, slender box, under the center line of the aircraft. Just about where the root of the main wing attached to the fuselage. And then, just to be a little bit different, a little bit more flashy, I put the vertical stabilizers canted at an angle out at the wingtips. And so after creating this, I took this drawing into Lockheed, and I was very proud of the drawing. And the two scientists that they brought in, and they literally had white lab coats on with the pocket protectors, the slide rule, the pens and everything, and the glasses, the receding hairline. I mean, it was like something out of a movie, because it was so cliche. But anyway, so they were sitting across the table from me, and I opened up my sketch pad, and I turned around, slid across the table to these two gentlemen. And almost immediately, there was this very clear, distressed look, is the best way I could put it, on their faces. They actually looked very surprised, but not in a good way. They looked upset. And I couldn't understand this, because I had put a lot of thought into this drawing. And so the one scientist, the one with the receding hairline, you could actually see beads of sweat starting to form on his forehead and his upper lip, and his hand started to shake, and he got real red in the face. And he finally slams his hand down on my drawing, and he says, "What are these damn canards, and what are these winglets out on the wingtips? They'd be torn off at Mach 17. And then he stops himself right in the middle of saying Mach 17. Okay, this is escape velocity from the Earth. That's fast enough to go out into space and not come back if you want to. And so that was something that I'm sure he never intended to say in front of me, because I didn't have a clearance to know that. But so the odd thing is that they then turned around and basically scrapped everything that I had done. And the impression I came away with was that what I had drawn was actually touching a nerve, that this apparently resembled something that they already had on the drawing boards, or something that may have even been close to operational status. And it was about 3, maybe 4 years later that my friend Bill Scott at Aviation Week, who is one of the editors over there, said that they got reports from some airline pilots coming out of Los Angeles International Airport that they had a near miss. They almost collided with an aircraft coming out of Nevada that looked exactly like this thing that I had drawn. Almost, for every detail was almost identical, including the vertical stabilizers moved out to the wingtips, the chine running down the side of the vehicle, the canards, everything. So then I understood completely why these two gentlemen were so upset. It wasn't because I had done a poor job. It was because I'd gotten very close to something that was already being worked on. And, it would have been fine if they just said, well, okay, you can't talk about this. But they acted like I was an imbecile and I didn't know what I was doing. And they tried to basically scoff at the prospect that anything that I had drawn could possibly function. But it turned out that this, in fact, was something that I think the aircraft that had the near miss was eventually referred to as the M-121. And it was actually considered to be a kind of carrier aircraft that would deploy a smaller and even faster vehicle from a piggyback kind of position, like a parasitic aircraft, very much like the D-21 drone that Lockheed had developed for the SR-71 Blackbird when it was still functioning as the YF-12A. So it's, years later in 1992 or 1993, I had some friends living in the community of Sierra Madre, which is right next to Pasadena in Southern California. It's right at the base of Mount Wilson, where the Mount Wilson Observatory is. They actually saw this aircraft, which apparently seemed to be in some kind of distress. The engine sounded like it was laboring, but the aircraft was huge. And in fact, it was being escorted by a pair of F-16s. And the witnesses, the friends of mine who actually saw this vehicle, said that the size comparison between the larger aircraft and the F-16 escort would be like comparing a dragonfly to a pair of mosquitoes. So but on top of everything else, this larger aircraft had another vehicle sitting on its back, right near the tail end of the fuselage above the main wing, which would also explain the need for moving the vertical stabilizers out to the wingtips to accommodate the positioning of this parasitic aircraft on the backbone, right, of this vehicle. So with all these things coming together, I begin to realize that there must, in fact, be some other kind of a program. This is where I began to realize that some of these systems were not only exo-atmospheric capable, in other words, capable of going out into space, air breathing all the same, but still having a capability of going out of space, but that some of these vehicles were employing technologies that were not fuel-burning vehicles, shall we say. They were not burning a kerosene-like jet fuel, but they were actually using some kind of field propulsion.
Right.
So, you know, I made an awful lot of contacts throughout the industry. I've known a lot of scientists who are renowned across the world for different kinds of special research that they've done. Hal Puthoff, for one, who's specialized in the research having to do with quantum zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum, or so-called zero-point energy. And I became aware that there were other programs, development programs, that had been going on for quite a long time that included technologies that most people would hear about the capabilities that these vehicles had and simply could not believe it. Imagine a vehicle that would travel through the atmosphere at speeds in excess of 9,000 miles an hour and not create a supersonic footprint. That is, right. There would be no sonic boom. Mm-hmm. Absolute silent, and yet traveling at speeds well above Mach 1. And at the same time, be able to maneuver in such a way that it could be traveling at that speed and make a right angle turn without even slowing down. Now, you know, I'd heard about this in some of the UFO accounts that people had shared with me, and I'd read about it in some of the books about UFOs and unidentified flying objects and so forth. And I always thought that, well, that's just physically impossible. There's no mm-hmm. way that a pilot could, make a right angle turn at those kinds of speeds and not be killed by the G-forces. And so I began looking at what the various possibilities might be within the physics science itself that would help to explain how you could accomplish something like this and not kill the pilot. And that was when, it was about around 1980 or so, I had just finished working with a special effects company in Hollywood, Introvision. They had done some special effects work for a couple of movies, Outland with Sean Connery and Saturn V with Farrah Fawcett and Mr. Douglas. I'm trying to remember his first name. Kirk Douglas.
Kirk, yeah.
And several other movies. And but the fellow who had created the Introvision camera system was a big follower of Tom Bearden's work. Tom Bearden was probably best known for discussing some of the research that was being done in the Soviet Union with what he called psychotronics, weapons that were applied that could use zero-point energy and so-called scalar waves to manipulate space and time, to transmit bursts of energy through hyperspace and have them sort of materialize at a distant location. And he went on to give several examples from the Vietnam War and also the destruction of the Thresher U.S. submarine in the 1960s that had all the earmarks of this sort of technology as a weapon being used against the United States. And so this in turn caused me to look at a lot of the literature that discussed zero-point energy and quantum physics. And I have to tell the audience, I don't have a degree in physics, but I know a lot of people who do. Mm-hmm. And so, even though I could not do one of these equations to save my life, what I have done is I spent a lot of time reading their peer-reviewed papers that are published in a number of the journals like Physics Review and so forth. And I essentially read the paragraph between the equations that explains what the equation is describing in terms of, physical events. you know, at the subatomic level or whatever it might be. And that is how I gained an understanding of how these things work. And so it turns out that you know, back when I was taking physics in high school, one of the things that I could never understand was when you talk about, you know, the laws of thermodynamics, you talk about the law of entropy, how everything, no matter what it is, eventually slows down because of frictional losses and this kind of thing.
Right.
Whether it's, you know, you throw a baseball or you kick a soccer ball, eventually it bounces and rolls and slows to a stop and that's it. But I could never understand why the structure of the atom did not do the same thing, that the planets moving around the sun never slow down. They, you know, the orbits don't disintegrate, you know, and planets don't start, you know, just wandering around the universe and bumping into each other, that everything keeps going as though there was this kind of magical free energy that just kept resupplying everything with the energy that it needed to keep going. And in fact, that is what zero-point energy turned out to be. It's a sort of an electrical charge, or flux, as it is sometimes called, electrical charge that's embedded in the fabric of space-time. And this is the energy that is absorbed by all the small components of the atom, the neutrons, the protons that are in the nucleus, the electrons that are spinning around the nucleus of the atom in the electron shell. This is what keeps them in motion all the time. And so when Einstein, many years ago, when he was talking about relativity and special relativity, talking about the fact that you could never go faster than the speed of light because as you accelerate through space-time, the mass of your vehicle increases to the point where it becomes almost infinite as you get closer and closer to the speed of light. And the reason for that is that just like droplets of rain suspended in the air, these little packets of quantum zero-point energy are distributed through the fabric of space-time. And as you move through space-time faster, the absorption rate increases. And so what happens is down at the atomic level, the electrons, protons, and neutrons in every atom of your vehicle and your body and the cargo and the ship, everything that's a part of that vehicle that's accelerating through space-time, it's absorbing more and more of the zero-point energy. So if you think of it like a gyroscope, the electrons start spinning faster and faster and faster because they become more and more energized by the absorption of more and more of the zero-point energy. So this is what contributes to the variable effect, the increased effect of mass, the thing that supposedly makes it impossible to continue going faster because you could just never have enough fuel to continue accelerating.
I thought the Earth is slowing down, though, right? They added an extra second a couple of years ago to the clock, etc. There is an entropy there, allegedly, right? But it's just because it's in the vacuum of space that it's not getting as much resistance as something would do in our atmosphere, right?
Well, I think that what you may be referring to is something called frame dragging, where there's actually an interaction between space-time and the planet itself. It may be true that the Earth is slowing down, but the pace at which it's slowing down is, it may be actually a variable. It may be something that changes over time, that sometimes it's faster, sometimes it's slower. And I have not seen that article, so I wouldn't be able to address the specifics of that with any degree of certainty, but
it's just that the mainstream scientists that talk about the, you know, the Earth-Moon system and that the moon is slowly kind of moving away from us, right? Tidal mm-hmm. acceleration, I think they refer to it as well, or tidal mm-hmm. forces between the natural satellites and everything. But so you're talking about a deeper, though, another type of energy that exists that you speculate that we can tap into. Is that correct?
Yes. And so what I'm suggesting is that if you found a way to tap into this energy that's embedded in space-time, number one, it eliminates the need for a large quantity of fuel in order to continue accelerating. And in fact, the faster you go, the more zero-point energy is going to be available for you to tap into as an energy source. Now, the side effect of all this is that when you tap into zero-point energy, it's no longer present. It's no longer available in the same quantity to continue increasing the mass of your vehicle. So as I'm imagining this, the faster you go, the more energy you have available, and the more of it that you pull out of space-time, the less of it there is to increase the mass of your vehicle. So it may actually be that in this particular relationship with this particular kind of technology, that relationship actually reverses itself. So it becomes inversely proportional. That is to say, the faster you go, the less your mass becomes. because you're actually absorbing more and more of the very energy that would be converting or increasing the mass of your vehicle. And so we know that mass is a variable, that it's not a physical quantity, so to speak, because if you accelerate, you can show with the different experiments that they've done that when an object accelerates, you can prove that the mass increases, but the minute it comes back to a rest where it stops, all of that additional energy that created the mass dissipates back into space. So we know it's a variable. So as long as we know it's a variable, we know that it can be modified. And in fact, if you go through even just a cursory search on the internet, you can find that the United States military, the Air Force in particular, has done an awful lot of experimentation and research into what are called mass modification experiments, ways of making something or affecting an object, whether it's an aircraft or some kind of a missile, rendering it or affecting it in such a way that its mass is somehow reduced. And if you can reduce the mass of a vehicle that has to maneuver through the air, that means that it doesn't take as much energy to make it change direction. So the further you get into the advanced parts of this science, you begin to see that the idea of making a right angle turn at 9,000 miles an hour actually starts to look as though it might be feasible. Now, that left the question for me of, and I've actually seen, you know, these kinds of events, an object traveling at well over 9,000 miles per hour through the air, making right angle turns and not producing a supersonic shockwave.
So sorry to interrupt. Let me ask you, how small do you think that would have to be able to pull that off?
The object itself, the vehicle?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you that I've personally seen aircraft or vehicles the size of an aircraft carrier doing this kind of stuff.
Well, exactly. So that's kind of bizarre in a way then, right? If it's about decreasing the mass of it.
Well, it seems obvious to me that to achieve that kind of capability, you would have to have a system that is capable of gathering the quantum zero-point energy from a much larger region around the vehicle than just within the space that the vehicle occupies itself. And that's kind of leading up to what I was going to say about not producing a supersonic shockwave, because if you're gathering zero-point energy from the environment and it extends out to, say, a certain event horizon around your vehicle, that means that even the air that's around the vehicle becomes what I call mass canceled or mass nullified in such a way that its interaction with this zero-point energy in the environment is dramatically reduced. So imagine this, that as you're traveling through the air, as this event horizon, the sort of the gathering mechanism, if you will, for the zero-point energy that's absorbed by the propulsion system, this event horizon is reaching out ahead of the vehicle, and it's basically canceling the effect of mass as it affects the air that's around and ahead of the vehicle. So as the vehicle physically begins to penetrate the air, the molecules there have no mass, and so they are displaced with no frictional losses whatsoever. And because there is no frictional losses, the actual displacement of the air does not create any energy transfer, which is part and parcel of what creating sonic boom is about. It's really just a bow shock wave, just like when you see a ship traveling through the water when the water is nice and smooth. You'll see these waves, these ripples coming off the bow of the ship. The sonic boom that's produced by an aircraft going through the air is very similar to that. And what is really happening when you have a sonic boom is that this energy transfer between the body of the aircraft and the air is pushing. It's creating a pushing effect on the air, if you will, that is causing the air to move aside at a rate or a speed that is faster than the speed of sound. And so what happens is the shock wave begins to pile up. The actual energy transfer to the atmosphere piles up and creates a cone-shaped kind of a shock wave that is what is responsible for creating the sonic boom. Now, most people think that it's because of the noise from the jet engine, but that's not, in fact, true. It's the actual energy transfer between the physical body of the vehicle displacing the air that causes a sonic boom. Because, after all, you can get a sonic boom from a rifle bullet. You can actually see it when you, if you're laying on the ground firing across the firing range where there's some soft sandy soil that's fairly flat between you and the target in the distance. You can actually see the ripple running across the surface of the sand as the projectile goes out to the target, and that's and that's part of what makes it difficult to silence a lot of munitions in the military and in recreational hunting, because the bullet itself travels at a supersonic speed, so you really can't eliminate the noise even with a suppressor in some instances. So a lot of the spy agencies use what are called subsonic munitions that are bullets that carry a lot of inertia, but they travel at slower than the speed of sound, so they're silent.
Interesting. Now, of course, there's so many things to this that we want to talk a little bit more about here, but let's try to tackle this question a little bit about origin points and discovery of some of these things that you were talking about. And obviously, the suggestion here that the aerospace manufacturers, the defense contractors, etc., they have figured this out already, right? So I wanted to ask you if there's been a smooth transition when it comes to the development of the types of aerospace crafts that we've kind of led up to today. Obviously, we need to talk a little bit more about that, where we are today and where the development are for these particular crafts and whatnot. But has there been a smooth development from the days when we started with the rocket industry, etc., or is there some kind of different variable that has come into the picture at some points that have taken the development into a new direction where we are today?
That's a very good question. I tend to look at the situation with these sorts of technologies as being very much like the evolution of the typical family car. If you go back to the early 1900s with the Model T and some of the early Mercedes-Benz vehicles, you can see that they had spoked wheels, they had narrow tires, fenders and running boards and windshields that folded down and were not very aerodynamic, had engines that were big hunks of iron that were not very efficient. But there's been so much technology, so much investigation that's been done in the last 100 years in the development of the automobile, for example, that you can see a clear progression over time in terms of the sophistication and the amount of thought that's gone into the design of these things. Everything from carburetors in the early years to direct injected fuel. These days, high compression engines with asymmetrical pistons that are coated with ceramics to reflect the heat. There is a wide variety of technologies that have been brought to bear in the automotive industry, and the same would apply to advanced technology vehicles like the so-called UFOs. And if you go back through the history of ufology and you look at a variety of the types of vehicles, and I've recently seen photographs that go all the way back to the 1870s near Mount Washington in New Hampshire. Some of the early UFO sightings look very archaic. They look very different than what we see today.
Exactly.
The vehicles that we're seeing today, many of them, and this is odd, there seem to be two families or two schools of thought when it comes to the design of these vehicles. One group is highly reflective, almost like polished chrome, almost like a mirror floating in the sky. And so under certain circumstances, they're almost impossible to see, especially if they're in the distance. I've seen a number of these vehicles, and with the naked eye, they're almost invisible. But if you look at them with a binocular, you can actually see some evidence of the ground reflected on certain parts of the ventral or the underside surfaces of these vehicles and things. The other school of thought seems to be sort of what you'd expect from people in the aerospace industry painting their vehicles with a flat black kind of a radar-absorbing paint. And so there's a family of discs that look something like a lens in shape with a slight bulge on the top, not so much like a canopy so much as just a slight raised area in the center of the vehicle. Many of these, this black vehicle, black UFO types, many of them have what resemble the kind of sort of light green anti-collision lights like you see on a lot of military aircraft on the sides and on the vertical stabilizers that are illuminated at night. They're not highly visible, but if you know where to look for them, you can see them. And so this seems to be kind of a giveaway, as far as I'm concerned, as to the possible military origin for these particular types of UFOs. And so when I look at some of the systems that I know were developed and designed back in the 1960s, such as the so-called Alien Reproduction Vehicle or Fluxliner, which was a Lockheed product.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that it's very clunky in appearance. It has a flat ventral surface. It looks a little bit like a slice taken out of the base of a cone, with the side sloping at about 35 degrees. It has a sort of a dome in the middle, which is actually the upper half of a sphere-shaped crew compartment. A surprisingly large amount of the structure of these vehicles is made out of composite materials like carbon fiber with a kind of a plastic resin binding agent. So they seem to be transparent as far as radar is concerned. They're very difficult to pick up on radar. The other surprising aspect of the technology is that the actual ability to achieve the performance that these things can do looks like it's very simple to create. I mean, I know this is going to sound outrageous when I say this, but the electrical system that makes this kind of a vehicle work looks like something so basic, so simple, albeit, you know, the physics involved is very complicated. But the actual mechanical structure of the vehicle appears so simple that you would imagine that a high school kid with, you know, an appropriate level of funding could probably build a small working model of one of these things. So let me see if I can't describe for you in very simple detail what the components of this kind of propulsion system look like, what they are.
Yeah.
Back in the 1930s, there was Alfred Biefeld and Thomas Townsend Brown came up with an observation from some of their experiments using plate capacitors, something that they called the Biefeld-Brown effect. Now, a capacitor is really nothing more than two conductive plates that are separated by an insulating material. It can be plastic, it can be air, it can even be a kind of quartz or a rubber. Even water, for that matter, can be used as a kind of a dielectric or an insulator between two conductive plates. And you hook these plates up to an electrical circuit. One of the plates will be positively charged and one of the plates will be negatively charged. And the natural tendency is for the plates to be attracted to one another because of the opposing polarity. Opposites attract, likes, you know, repel. But in this case, because they cannot make contact with one another, the electrons that are in the circuit tend to accumulate on the surfaces that are closest to the plates at the, you know, the nearest proximity. And so it builds up a charge. And this charge can be, well, there are instances where they have what are called variable capacitors, which you haven't seen in many years since the days of vacuum tube radios and so forth. But be it enough to say that if you stack enough of these plates up and you alternate the plates in polarity, so it's negative, positive, negative, positive, negative, positive, as you stack them up, and you put them into a glass-like substance that's, you know, very, very good at insulating and protecting the two components from arcing over or shorting out, so to speak, that you can actually create a powerful levitating effect with these capacitors. Now, this by itself is really not what makes these things fly. This is just one of the, you know, the side effects that you find with this particular kind of component. But the scientist that we know as Nikola Tesla, who's responsible for alternating current and remotely piloted vehicles and electronically controlling, you know, creating radio signals. And I guess there was even a settlement years after his death regarding who was the first one to create the transmission of telemetry over radio. And I think he won out over Marconi even. But, you know, these are some of the things that the brilliant mind of Nikola Tesla came up with all those years ago. And it turned out that he found that you could take coils of wire of different lengths, and it was a very specific measurement. But you could find sort of a resonant frequency, that is to say, the length of the wire would accommodate a particular repetitive rate of the electrical pulse that would go through the wire. And if you had, say, a wire that was, 100 feet long and one that was, 15 feet long, you could find this resonance where at a particular frequency that both of these wires would be in resonance with one another. And if they were set up so that one was within, was inside the other, sort of like a totem pole surrounded by a hula hoop or a ring, that you could take the shorter wire in a large loop that went around the circumference, and the longer wire that would be on the long pole-like structure in the middle, and you could create a high voltage output as a result of that resonance in the circuit. And part of the circuit, of course, involves storing some of the energy on capacitors. And so when you combine the components of these propulsion systems, you find that this is really the three components that you see is a primary set of windings, a secondary set of windings on a central column, and then a series of capacitors that are they're oriented like many, many thin slices of a pizza pie, all sort of, the points all coming together in the middle right below this the central column that is the secondary windings of the Tesla coil. So what you have is a system that can create extremely high voltages. And then there's another feature, and this is something that I've only more recently become aware of, is that the primary windings are actually embedded in a special kind of quartz themselves, but there is a kind of unique arrangement in the way that this set of primary windings is structured, and that is to say that the coils are actually made of a kind of copper tubing with a fiber optic cable on the inside, and that entire assembly is then embedded in a quartz ring that completely isolates the coils from anything else in the circuit. Now, the fiber optic windings actually extend into the inside of this secondary windings, this column that stands in the middle of the apparatus. And inside of that set of windings is actually a kind of a tube. Almost like, imagine like a fluorescent light bulb filled with a mercury vapor. And on the inside of that tube, these fiber optic lines run up inside there around the inside. Looks a little bit like a bottle brush running in a spiral around the inside of this tube. And when this Tesla coil discharges, if you've ever seen a Tesla coil demonstrated in public, you can see these big lightning bolt type discharges. Well, in this case, The lightning, so to speak, is being discharged down through the center of this tube through the mercury. And it creates a kind of high energy, almost like an X-ray photon. And those X-ray photons are then picked up by these fiber optic elements that then circulate back through the inside of the copper tubing that's in this set of windings around the outside of the crew compartment on this particular kind of vehicle. And apparently, what happens when you structure the system in this way is it creates an effect that the physicists called frame dragging. It actually modifies the pace of time. It's not uncommon for people who have had encounters with UFOs to talk about missing time. In the physics community, this is actually referred to as time dilation, where everyone else around you thinks that it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and they've been going along their merry way thinking everything was fine. You, on the other hand, have had this encounter with a vehicle that's using this unusual technology, and you find that for you, it's actually 8 o'clock in the morning, that you've lost an entire hour of time, even though the sensation of the time passing would be the same for you or the people that are, standing outside the affected region. As far as the watch on your wrist is concerned, though, it's 8 o'clock in the morning and you're missing a whole hour of time. Now, I've actually experienced that myself. And the very interesting part of this was that you know, once I had received reports from some of my contacts in the industry that this technology was out there, it occurred to me that, and I thought it was ridiculous at first, but it occurred to me that there might be something to this so-called alien abduction phenomena, that people mm-hmm. might really be, you know, being grabbed by people from some other star system and, you know, being poked and prodded, and maybe some tissue samples or blood samples being taken, you know, for genetic material experiments and this kind of thing. So I thought, well, okay, if that's true, if that is happening, then there might be a chance, however slim, that they might have gotten a tour of the spacecraft. They might have gotten a chance to see the engine room or whatever it is that makes these things go.
Right.
And so I had an opportunity to overhear a radio program where a number of these young ladies were being interviewed who claimed that they had, in fact, been abducted by aliens and taken up in flying saucers and experimented on. And so I contacted the host of the program, and I said, you know, I work as a conceptual artist in the defense industry, and I would really like to be able to sit down with these young ladies and talk to them about their experiences and see if, you know, there's anything that they can shed, if they can shed any light on what, you know, the technology might be that makes you know, these different craft operate and
right.
gives them the capabilities that we've seen. And so what was really striking, stunning actually for me, was to find that without showing or telling these young ladies anything about what I already knew regarding the technology, they were describing components and systems that looked very much like the things that I knew to exist. And that to me was it was an odd feeling to see confirmation from such a strange and anomalous source as someone claiming that they'd been abducted by aliens, to describe a central column with a mercury-like substance circulating through it, with spinning components very much like some of the things that were in this propulsion system in the alien reproduction vehicle. And so it lent an added layer of credibility to these stories. And, you know, after a while, when I begin to interview some of these young ladies, I could tell the ones that were, you know, just attention seekers and you know, love to have somebody sit down and do some sketches about their alleged encounter. And there were other people, you could tell that they had been traumatized by their experiences, that there were people who could not keep a job because it had so dramatically affected them psychologically. And you know, some of these people were very intelligent, very articulate, were able, even though they didn't understand what they were looking at, they were able to describe the components that they did see and, you know, the materials that they appeared to be made out of. And the correlation between what they were reporting and what I knew already to be true was remarkable.
Wow, interesting. Truly
really remarkable.
Well, I definitely want to ask you more about this, and obviously the interface then between, you know, the development here in some of the things you described before of this type of technology and what it can produce, and of course why and how it shows up, looking very much the same in an allegedly alien craft, right? So let's get into that in the second segment. There's a couple of things I want to give out here, though, before we take a short break here. And obviously, Mark will be speaking at the Secret Space Program, the conference in San Mateo, June 28th and 29th. In California, of course, and talk more about zero-point energy and the power source, you know, basically behind what powers the Secret Space Program. So much more of that there. I want to mention some of the other speakers as well. We have Catherine Austin Fitz, Carol Rosen, Joseph P. Farrell, Richard Dolan, Michael Schratt, Robert Morningstar, and also John Rappaport, and I'm going to be hosting the conference as well. So please, if you want to find out more, you know, information, schedule, tickets, and everything else, secretspaceprogram.org. That's the website for more on that. And I wanted to ask you as well, Mark, for your website, if there's any other pages you'd like to give out. I don't know if you have any books or otherwise something else out there that people can dig into for more of the kind of thing that you're talking about.
Well, at the present, I'm busy working on a book. Part of what I felt would make the reading a little more interesting was adding some of my illustration work to help to flesh out the story. And of course, that takes a little more time than just sitting at a typewriter or a computer. I have someone who's expressed an interest in publishing it, and I'm very excited about that. My website is markmcanlish.com and www.markmcanlish.com. I'm also on Facebook, Mark McCandlish on Facebook. And, I've done a number of drawings recently that, that describe some of the events which helped make me aware of the technology, the circumstances under which these things were revealed. And so a lot of that will be presented at the Secret Space Program conference. And so I'm looking forward to being able to share a lot of that with the audience. And I think I'll probably pose a few questions to the audience, you know, help to sort of stimulate their imaginations, help them to understand why there could be a secret space program, why there might be breakaway civilizations that are living among us right under our noses, so to speak, what the purpose behind that might be. And it's not all bad as far as I can tell. I mean, there may be some very good reasons for this.
Right.
Environmentally, one of the sort of universal themes that I've seen throughout these kinds of events and encounters is what seems to be a very overt expression on the part of the entities, whoever they are, regarding the care and treatment of our planet and the other creatures that we share it with, which is something that I've become a big advocate for myself. You know, I spent 30 years working in the defense industry, and there are times when, you know, I have to deal with the sense of guilt that I have knowing that I contributed to the design and development of weapon systems that were probably responsible for killing a lot of people, and that's not a good feeling. And so one of the ways that I try to pay back is to help people understand the truly bright future that we might all be able to experience in the future by the development of some of these technologies for peaceful means, for the creation of energies, energy technologies that are not polluting in the way that the technologies that we've been using for the last couple hundred years are, and do not leave a radioactive footprint like the unfortunate scenario we have at Fukushima in Japan right now.
Right, yeah.
You know, I think it's a very important thing. It's not just about little green men and flying saucers. There's you know, many deeper and more profound layers to this entire discussion that I would like to engage the audience in, and I think it's a discussion that's well worth having.
Well, indeed, exactly. Bring up some interesting points there. See if we can get into some of that more in the second as well. We're going to have all the links from redicecreations.com and, of course, Mark. McCandlish.com, that's the website, and we'll link up the Facebook page for that as well. We'll carry on here in a little bit. Stay with us, Mark. We'll be right back.